Well, look, I've been saying for some weeks now that there's going to be a riot in Ephesus. It was bound to happen. There's just about been a riot everywhere that Paul has been. And here in Ephesus, the riot has not been instigated by the Jews, as in most other places, but by prominent members of the local Chamber of Commerce, of all things. So let's look at this passage of Scripture, and let's see how it will affect us today. It's a story, it's a narrative, but it has profound modern implications, because we live in a pagan age, don't we? And it's getting more pagan by the day. And I think that in this pagan age in which we live, nominal Christianity will very quickly fall by the wayside. You know what I mean by nominal Christianity? People who are Christians in name only. People who have a mere nominal faith. People whose Christianity depends on emotionally driven experiences. I don't think that's going to last when things get really tough. And I think they are going to get tough. So let's begin with the beginning of the story. Paul's preaching and the work of his fellow evangelists at Ephesus has had great success. The gospel has spread far and wide right across the Roman province of Asia. Many people have come to Christ. Many people have been saved. Their sins have been forgiven and they've been brought into God's kingdom. But you see, the Apostle Paul, one of the things that we have learned over the past weeks and months is that the Apostle Paul isn't one of these preachers who's concerned with counting hands in a meeting. He's not concerned about the number of conversions so that he can go to the ministers fraternal in Ephesus on a Monday morning and say to them, "We had 28 souls last night. How many had you?" That's not what Paul does. One thing that we have learned is that Paul was interested not just in conversions, but in discipleship. That's why he spent all those hours teaching. Do you remember how we talked about his time teaching in the lecture hall of Tyrannus? Do you remember how we talked about him being there working with his hands, working with the sweat of his brow from early morning till 11 o'clock, and then when the city went to sleep for the hot hours of the day, he would go to the lecture hall and he would gather his students around him and he would teach there until 4 o'clock in the afternoon when the city came to life again. And then he would go back to his work in the stitching factory, making tents. And all of that effort, do you think for those 5 hours or 6 hours that he was teaching every day, day after day after day after day, week after week for 3 years, do you think he was doing that and just counting hands? He was making disciples. He was teaching Christian doctrine. He was preparing people for what lay ahead. These Ephesian believers were serious about their faith and about their Christianity. One of the results of this was that there was a serious decline in the sale of silly trinkets. First thing I want you to notice today is that serious Christianity, discipleship, true discipleship, affects the way you spend your money. Yes, it does. The sale of idols was big business in Ephesus. So we're going to be introduced to one of those who have been greatly financially impacted by the downturn in sales that happens when God changes the heart of a sinner. A man called Demetrius. Demetrius is the leader of the Guild of Silversmiths. It's a kind of a trade union with wider social connections, and these silversmiths are well paid. They're a well-paid profession. They were manufacturers of little imitation shrines. The city of Ephesus, remember, the centerpiece of the city was the shrine of the temple Diana, the temple of the goddess Diana, or Artemis, as she's sometimes known, the false goddess. And these silversmiths would have fashioned little shrines of the goddess herself and of the temple itself. And people then going to the temple of Diana, they would have bought these little silver ornaments and they would have taken them into the temple and they would have offered up the silver gift as a sacrifice to the false goddess. And guess what happened then? The priests took it and they melted it down. And they sold the melted silver back to the silversmiths. You see, even in ancient pagan religion, money makes the world go round. And the silversmiths took the melted silver and made more idols, sold them to more pilgrims, and the priests got more money. And the only people who were being ripped off were the people who were there to worship the false goddess. And of course, Ephesus was a tourist destination. People came from all over. The temple at Ephesus, the temple of Diana, was one of the seven wonders of the world. It was four times bigger than the Parthenon on the Areopagus in Athens. It was supported by 127 ornate pillars, all of them 60 foot high, every one of them donated by a king or a ruler right across the world. And tourists would come, and they couldn't take photographs in those days. They might have made a drawing of the temple, but they would have bought a little mini silver temple to take home with them, so they could have their false goddess in their comfort of their own home. But this preaching of Paul has changed all that. Demetrius the silversmith calls this trade union meeting to discuss the impact of this Christianity on his trade. You can see his speech here in the passage. In verse 24, for example, he is gathered up and it says that he earned no small gain as a craftsman. And he called together in verse 25 those of like occupation, and he begins to give them this great speech. He talks about the economics that have changed. You see, there's no better way to rouse a rabble than by hitting them with financial reality. These were wealthy men, these smiths. And Paul's preaching was destroying their business, and so he called them together and he told them that they had this wealth and that the wealth was being taken from them, and he appealed to their national interest and their civic pride and their emotional attachment with their city. Not only an appeal to their pockets, but an appeal to their citizenship. For the temple of Diana is the crowning glory of the city of Ephesus. They had a worldwide reputation. Verse 27, so that not only this our craft is in danger, but also that the temple of the great goddess Diana should be despised and her magnificence should be destroyed, whom all Asia and the world worshipeth. Now you add those two factors together, economics and civic pride, and you have a powerful combination. And so in verse 28, when they heard these sayings, they were full of wrath. And they spilled out into the streets, shouting, "Great is Artemis," or "Great is Diana." And some people see that, some commentators see that as being very similar to a kind of a cultic cry. I suppose the nearest thing to it today might be when you watch crowds of Muslims outside a school in England where somebody has offended their prophet by teaching a class in a RE class. And you'll see them standing outside and they are thrusting their fists into the air like that. And they're shouting, Allah Akbar, Allah is great. Nothing new about such angry, threatening mobs. It was happening in the day of the Book of Acts. And they made their way to this great open-air theatre. There's a huge auditorium in the city of Ephesus. It seats just under 25,000 people. And on the way there, they found two Christians. Look at verse 29. The whole city was filled with confusion. And having caught Gaius and Aristarchus, men of Macedonia, Paul's companions in travel, they rushed with one accord into the theatre. And there they have these two Christians, and they have come into this public arena. Now let's just pause for a wee moment, because we have to apply some of this. Up to now, this has just been history and narrative. But let's think about it. What was causing all the problems? It was the fact that when people come to Christ, when they are truly discipled, their purchase history will change. When we're saved, it affects how we spend our money, doesn't it? And much of the spending of this world is on cosmetics and self-enhancement and pleasure and alcohol, various drugs. And the idols of this world cost a lot of money. This morning in the other place, I was preaching on Isaiah chapter 55. And I had intended, of course, to preach on verse 6 and 7 on seeking the Lord. But while I was reading the passage this morning, I don't make a habit of preparing sermons before I go out in the morning, but I was reading over the passage just to refresh my mind. And verse 2 of Isaiah 55 struck me. Wherefore do ye spend money for that which is not bread? Bread's the essential, isn't it? It's the staff of life. We have to have bread. We have to have food. What are you doing? Spending money on silly things that you don't need. What are you doing? Spending money on stuff that will pass away. Many Christians today spend their money foolishly, longing for the latest iPhone, or the latest trinket or gadget, or the latest, most expensive pair of trainers, or to have their kids dressed in clothes that they can't afford, or whatever. These Ephesians Christians, they used to spend their money on such things. These Ephesians, these Asians, they used to spend their money on silly little silver trinkets that somebody else would melt down and make a fortune out of them. But now they've got different perspectives. Their priorities have changed. It reminds me of the 1920s in Belfast. I'm sure you know the story of the revival that happened in Belfast under the late W.P. Nicholson, where hundreds of people in East Belfast were won for Christ. I remember looking through when I was a minister in East Belfast. I remember looking through the old church records going back to the 1920s and finding session minute books that were recording that in those days there were so many children going to the Sunday school. In that one church, over 1,000 children weekly attending Sunday school across a number of venues at a number of different times. thanks to the preaching of W.P. Nicholson. And isn't it said that Harland and Wolff Shipyard had to build a large shed to house all the stolen tools and parts that were being returned because the workers had been saved and were bringing back the stuff that they stole. And they had new priorities in their life. And that's the challenge for us. How has our conversion, our discipleship, affected our stewardship of our resources? First point, serious Christianity, discipleship, which Paul was promoting, will always affect the economy. Secondly, serious Christianity will always put Christ first and not me. Look at verse 30 down to verse 34, and let's go back to our narrative. Because right now the mob's in the city theatre, and they are howlingly for blood. And as the Smiths had travelled into the city, they're joined by others who haven't even got a clue what the riot's about. In verse 32, some therefore cried one thing and some another, for the assembly was confused. People were just joining in. You know, as we know well about these parts, there's nothing like a wee bit of recreational rioting to while away an evening. At that point, Paul is motivated to intervene. He would have gone into the crowd. He would have declared unto them the gospel. Verse 30 and verse 31, it says, when Paul would have entered in unto the people, the disciples suffered him not, and certain of the chief of Asia, which were his friends, sent unto him, desiring him that he would not adventure himself into the theatre. Paul was ready to walk into that howling mob of 20,000 or so people filling that stadium and stand up and declare the gospel. It was a brave thing to do, given the anger of the crowd. It took the disciples to hold him back and not allow him to do so. Even some of the rulers of Asia, the so-called Asiarchs, called upon him not to go into the crowd. Friends of Paul. And then Alexander intervened. And we're introduced briefly to another citizen of the city of Ephesus. A spokesman for the Jewish minority, a man called Alexander. You see, the Jews had much to lose here. If this situation gets out of hand, they are in serious trouble, because the average pagan in those days didn't actually know the difference between a Jew and a Jewish Christian. A bit like today. There are some people in the pagan land in which we live who don't know the difference between a genuine Christian who's had an experience of God's salvation and a person who goes to church. They're just all Christians to them. So Paul's a Jew. And like Paul, the Jews didn't offer sacrifices to false goddesses. And like Paul, the Jews didn't buy anything from the silversmiths. And like Paul, they would be accused of being disbelievers in the goddess. And this could lead to a serious situation. What if the pagans, what if they think that Paul and the Jews are just the same? So they thrust forward their spokesman to defend their position and to stand and denounce Paul and announce and assure the crowd that it's not their fault. Verse 33, they drew Alexander out of the multitude. The Jews put him forward. Alexander stood and beckoned with the hand and would have made his defense unto the people. But when they knew that he was a Jew, all with one voice about the space of 2 hours, cried out, great as Diana. The crowd are in no mood for Jews. I would say Alexander's intervention here has made things worse. The chanting and the shouting goes on for 2 hours. Now let's think of the motivation of these people. Demetrius here is motivated only by cash. All he's about is money. This silversmith, he brought great gain from making these silly little trinkets. Alexander, the Jew, he's motivated by caution. He wanted to be able to live on safely dwelling in this prosperous and desirable location. He didn't want to be sent out of the town. He didn't want to be exiled, perhaps like the Jews at Rome were when Nero blamed them for the great fire. Demetrius, motivated by cash. Alexander, motivated by caution. Paul, motivated by Christ. Contrast both those attitudes with what drives Paul on here. You see, Paul's not concerned about his own safety. He'll walk right into a mob of 20,000 people, angry people who don't want anything Christian said to them, and he'll go straight in and he'll preach the gospel if he could. He's not concerned about making a good living. He's not concerned about having clean hands or finding a nice, pleasant residential area or seeking some earthly comfort. He said, "For me to live is Christ and to die is gain." We're talking outside there about the new religion of the world. You know, the religion that's going around now where you have to agree wholeheartedly or you'll be a heretic. One of the tenets of the new religion is that we have to be safe. Stay safe. Be safe. But the Christian life's not about being safe. It's about being saved. Being saved by God's grace. It's about laying down your life. It's about giving up your desires so that Christ can have you wholeheartedly. The seriousness here of Christianity, the seriousness of Paul, the seriousness of the early disciples, they took seriously the call of Christ to stand for him, the call of Christ to deny themselves and take up their cross and follow Jesus, even if it cost them everything, even at the cost of their lives. Our motives, the purpose of our lives, is vastly and radically different from that of the pagan world. So discipleship for the Lord Jesus will always affect how you use your resources. And it will always mean that you will put Christ first and not yourself. And finally, serious discipleship will always overcome in this world, despite the setbacks and despite the obstacles. I'm going to introduce you to one more character. Let's call him the town clerk. He comes in here in verse 35, when the town clerk had appeased the people. In the Greek, he's called the grammateus, so he's the city correspondent. He's like the registrar of the city. He's a high-ranking municipal civil servant, and he's the man who acts as go-between, writing the letters, liaising between the local city council here in Ephesus and the Roman provincial government, who ultimately hold him responsible, along with his fellow councillors, for what happens in the city. And believe you me, the sanctions that Rome imposes can be extremely crippling, physically. And so to make matters worse, the Roman embassy, the provincial government, the local provincial offices are situated right there in the city of Ephesus. And it's only a matter of time before someone in the Roman office opens his window and hears the noise coming from the auditorium. And the Romans don't like riots. I talked to you before about the Lex Romana, the law of Rome, and the Pax Romana, the peace of Rome, and the police state of Rome. They don't like it at all. So the town clerk goes into the crowd and he placates them. He uses a bit of dodgy reasoning. In verse 35 and verse 36, he says, when the town clerk had appeased the people, he said, "Ye men of Ephesus, what man is there that knoweth not that this city of the Ephesians is a worshipper of the great goddess Diana?" Everybody knows we worship Diana. "And of the image which fell down from Jupiter." Aye, that's right. They thought Diana fell down from Jupiter. It was a black stone. It was probably a meteorite. "Seeing then that these things cannot be spoken against, you ought to be quiet and do nothing rashly." You see what he's up to there. We would call it putting two and two together and getting five. Everybody knows Diana all over the world. And plus, Ephesus is the place where Diana lives. Therefore, Diana must be a god. One and one makes six. Ridiculous. You know, just because a proposition is popular, that doesn't make it right. Popular opinions can change or be manipulated to change. That's what he's doing. He's using what we would call a logical fallacy. And he's talking about the innocence of the Christians. He's actually standing up for them. Innocent, of course, in the sense that he rightly saw that Paul and the believers in Ephesus had not provoked this riot. They'd not destroyed the pagan temple. They'd not attacked it. They'd not even preached about Diana. And I think that's something that we ought to take note of. Of course, Paul, in his teaching, would have made it absolutely clear that there was no God but the true God. And of course he had said, as we look at verse 26, the silversmith knew this, Demetrius knew it, saying that they be no gods which are made with hands. He'd heard that. Paul teaches that if you make a god with hands, it's just an idol. It's not a god at all. Anything that's made by us for worship is just an idol. I knew that. And yet, the thrust of Paul's gospel preaching is not about idols, it's about Christ. So therefore, the town clerk was able to say in verse 37, "You have brought hither these men, which are neither robbers nor of churches, nor yet blasphemers of your goddess." So Paul's preaching wasn't just a tirade against false religions all the time. He preached Christ and him crucified. It's evangelistic. It's Christ-centered. He preaches Christ alone. And then he talks about suing in sessions. His final point's a legal one in verse 38. He says here, "Wherefore, if Demetrius and the craftsmen which are with him have a matter against any man, the law is open, and there are deputies, let them implead one another." If you have a problem with these men, sue them in the courts. Because if you don't, Rome will step in, verse 40. "For we endanger to be called in question for this day's uproar." Now let's compare these Ephesian pagan methods with Paul. The method of the pagans is loud and bombastic and assertive. They're saying, "We have the numbers, we have the popularity, we have the power, we have the right to decide whose opinion can prevail in this city and in this province. But Paul's evangelistic strategy in the face of that is simply to preach Christ and Him crucified. Simply to declare the gospel message of saving faith to all men everywhere. Simply to bring glory to God through the salvation of souls. He's not employing the methods of the Ephesians. He's not going to appeal to wealth or appeal to emotion or appeal to popularity. He's not going to use the duplicitous cunning and the legal threats of the town clerk. He's going to preach Christ and Him crucified. And I say to you, that is what will prevail over everything else. Now, hold on. I know that we have legal rights. I know that we have politicians. I know that we have the right to go to court, and we've done that before. Christians have gone to court to defend themselves. I know that. And I know that it was proper to do that. I know that there are times when we must take a stand for ourselves. But I say to you now that the only thing that will prevail in this world is to preach the Lord Jesus Christ. Nothing else. And here's my proof. Nobody worships Diana of the Ephesians nowadays. Millions of people in all ages have and will worship Jesus. The answer to every political dilemma, moral dilemma, riot in the city, uproar among pagans, chants against Christianity, is just simply to stand up and declare that Jesus is Lord. And Paul said, 1 Corinthians, my speech and my preaching was not even with enticing words of man's wisdom, but in demonstration of the Spirit and of power, that your faith should not stand in the wisdom of men, but in the power of God.